This is April the 10th, and we are up at the site of Bastien Fischer's home place. And while I'm taking some pictures, he's going to talk about what the house looked like when it did stand in this setting.
Barbara, that house is about 30 feet there. On the low side, it's about 30 feet.
So it'll hear.
Okay, closer to it, in other words.
Right.
Okay. The microphone's on top here, right?
Yeah.
See the old house, the back door of it was right up on the bank like that. Of course, now this has been pushed out since then. This year was just nothing but a sloping hill down this way.
Oh, you mean the house sat right up there?
It sat right up there, Yes, ma'am. Of course, the lower side of it was down probably farther than that bank is right now. Is that in there straight, Barbara? Is the solar film in there straight? Barbara, this was a three-story house with a basement and the main floor, and then it was an attic upstairs with one big room in it. It had a sloping porch on the front of it with hand-hewed timbers that was just cut in the mountain, just put up there, and then the roof was put on.
And then this, it all came toward us. It faced us.
The peak of the house faced us, mm-hmm. Right. And of course, back in those days when they built a house, anywhere you find a spring, you'll find a house. No matter where the spring is, you'll find a house, foundation side of a spring every time. I can show you a dozen up on the mountain here when we go around. Now I got a little pond here right now. I pushed it out several years ago. It said we'll have a spring here, and then we'll have a spring coming out of the mountain up here. So it's two good springs right here. And these springs have never been known to go dry. It's water in them year-round, all the time.
Ice cold.
It's about 56 degrees.
That's where I was going to just get up
here. We might get one from right up there across here and get the house light and everything, Barbara. Barbara, it's a foundation of an old house right up over top of this mountain, about 300 yards back from the tip top of this here ridge right here, and naturally it's a spring right over from it. Now we can get right up there within 100 yards of this house by going up this ridge right here. But now that's, unless you have a lot of time, you don't want to do that, you know. But it takes about 15 minutes to walk from right here to the Skyline Drive up this road right here. It's right that goes right through here. And we used to pick strawberries up on the Skyline Drive. About 10 children would go up there, and we used to pick strawberries to sell. That's how we made our living, picking berries, picking peaches and apples. And of course, in the wintertime, we cut a lot of wood. And of course, in the fall, we hunted a lot of ginseng. And that's the way the mountain people made their living. And they raised big families doing it. Back in 1948, this whole mountain here burned over. The city dump of Waynesboro caught on fire and caught the mountain on fire. And that fire burnt almost all the way down to Front Royal, Virginia. And that year, after that, and the following year, there were 49 or 50. My family, it was 9 children and mom and dad. And we picked 800 gallons of huckleberries and sold them that year. Can you imagine what 800 gallons of huckleberries is?
A lot of huckleberries. Now talk about it,
sir. Okay. Barbara, the road that goes up to that hill there is Germans Gap Road. And if you take the fork to the right, you go right up over the Skyline Drive. And if you take the fork of the road that goes to the left, you go straight up through Calvert's Hollow. And when the park bought this land, took this land, they run 4 or 5, maybe as many as 8 families out of the hill. Now, those families that lived up there were just regular mountain people, but they owned different livestock, like horses, cows, and maybe a few sheep. And they had their fences well fenced in around there. And later on, years after the park moved these people out, My dad went up there in that hire and got enough of wire off the fences and brought it down here to fence 31 acres around here. He carried it back here on his shoulder. He'd go up there one day and maybe bring back two rolls, go up there a day later and bring back two more rolls. So it will give you an idea of how many people did live up there. It was just a small little
community. Now, do you think in this particular little group of people that you're talking about, it was where they had a church and...
No, the church was right... I wanted to show you that on the way up here, but we passed right by the church site on the way up here. I'll show it to you on the way back down.
So they came down the hollow to the church?
Uh-huh. If they went to church, mm-hmm. they came down and it was about 100 yards on the other side where I showed you Charles Gap right mm-hmm. there.
Needed like flour or any kind of staples like that. They had to come out
to get it.
And go to Waynesboro.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them would stock up on that stuff.
By the barrel.
For the winter, by the barrel. Uh-huh.
Now tell me why you said it had an interesting story about why it got that name.
Okay. During the First World War, the U.S. troops was training all over the United States. And the cavalry came through here on horseback and rode up that hollow, and that is how that hollow got its name. And I'm fairly sure that it's just a tale that's been sent from one generation down to the other. But I believe that's how some people call that Calvary's Hollow. It's not on the map as that or anything. It's only local people that call it Calvary's Hollow. If you mention Calvary's Hollow to anybody around here, they would know exactly where it was.
Now tell me, so we can record, what you were talking about the people that were named Macaulay and Craig.
Okay.
McCraig.
All right.
How they might have changed their name.
All right. I kind of figured always that the McCraigs came to the United States with the name McCraig. And I figured after they got here that they shortened it to just Craig. But now it's an old tale that people around here has been telling for many, many years that it was a bunch of Macaulays around and there were some Craigs around, and the parents of the girls didn't want them to lose their name, and the Craigs, they didn't want their daughters to lose their name. So when the Craigs and Macaulay started marrying each other, they took on the name of McCraig, including Macaulay and Craig in that. And that's the tale that came from generations down, so maybe that is the way it was.
Ready to go.
Should be ready. Robert, now that's the road we just came through down there, out of Calf Mountain, from my place. My place is right back of this little ridge right here. In fact, the top of that ridge is my land, okay?
Well, that green that I see is your trees?
No.
Those little bit of brighter green.
Right, that's right down that way from my trees, okay? You can't see none of my trees because they're right behind this little ridge here. But now that's where I told you my cousin's two daughters lived,
mm-hmm.
and those pines are.
Right.
That's where they live, okay? And of course, that's right up the mountain. We came right out there.
That's not the road that the Indian is doing.
Yeah, right.
It
yeah,
is?
That's it. Uh-huh. That's it. Uh-huh.
Well, then, and he's bought the whole top of that little small mountain.
The whole top of that little small mountain, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, so.
Let me try to get one. You go on and talk about the story here.
Okay.
I think the idea of a person from India buying the top of the mountain
uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
putting in a... Just most unusual.
Yeah. Now he's done put perk holes all over the top of that mountain border. Now you can definitely see Calvary's Hollow. See that whole hollow is Calvary's Hollow, okay? Going from right yonder, where you can see the last house there, all the way up through yonder, that's Calvary's Hollow. Okay?
And on up over those mountains?
Right, uh-huh.
Goes all the way up?
Yeah, that's what we call Calvary's Hollow, uh-huh. And people used to live up in those, down in the bottom of the hollow, just everywhere up through there, you know. Uh-huh. And of course, now you see these little mountains that's coming down to that hollow. They have hollows in them going up this way, okay?
Yeah.
Each and every one.
The other direction.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Calvary Hollow, they were moved, but the hollows that went off in the other directions, were those people moved too?
No, it wasn't too many people to live up in those hollows because the mountains is too steep coming down this road.
Mm-hmm.
But now Calvary's Hollow, you can see there's a lot of level rain,
yeah.
You know, so, and all in those level spots are people used to live. Uh-huh.
Now you said this is
McCormick's Gap right here, and the Bear Den, brother, is right over here, and it takes about five minutes to walk down to it, but it's right down over the cliff, right over here.
And you say Bear Den, you mean where they actually hibernate?
Oh, they used to hibernate in it.
They don't anymore?
Not anymore, because the rock has slipped down over the edge, and you can barely see back in there now. Uh-huh. But people used to say that there was a big cave back in there, but now the big rock over the entrance has just, like, over the years, just kept coming down.
Now, when you came up here to pick berries, did you see bear?
No. Well, I've seen bear all over this mountain. In fact, I've probably seen as many as 15, 20 bear on this mountain in my life. Uh-huh. And, of course, my son's still hunting. They see bear for all time. See this little green field right over here?
Yes.
And that's what's called Lindsay's Level, okay? And the reason it's called Lindsay's Level is because right on the other side of that hill, down on the other side of the mountain there, Fellow Lindsay came through one time through the mountains, and he stole one of my great-granddad's horses. And when he came by Uncle Hughes's house that lives right down over there, Uncle Hughes recognized the horse, and he stopped him and held him until he sent word over to my great-granddad that the fellow over here had one of his horses, and he wanted to make sure it was okay. My great-grandpap got together with a few of the people and came over there and hung Mr. Lindsay on a fatal tree right next to Uncle Hughes' house down there. Now, I'm going to show you this now. It's a truth. I still show you the tree that they hung him at.
Well, you didn't steal horses.
Oh, and that's why they call it Lindsay's Level.
Where you see the green right over there?
That's called Lindsay's Level, yes, sir. Now, that's one of the stories, and of course, it's something to it because it's been, you know, in the family for many, many years, you know. And they handled their own business in those days. They
didn't,
They didn't know. They didn't.
Well, if they had to wait for the sheriff to come.
The sheriff would never get there. He didn't bother these mountain people anyway back in those days. In fact, say 40 years ago, the sheriff didn't come out to Calf Mountain. They expected the people out there to handle their own problems. I had a deputy sheriff tell me here about 22 years ago. He said, "Well, I've seen," he said, "I don't understand it." He said, "These people out here used to handle their own problems. Says every now and then somebody calls the sheriff's department." And I told him, I said, "George," I said, "that's just one of the younger people." I said, "The older people out here still handle their own affairs."
In other words, the ones who are second and third generation from those who were moved off the mountain, you still are rather clannish.
Pretty much. Yes. I mean, all those people down there are just like a clan. And, I mean, in fact, me and my family is just about the only ones that has moved out of that hollow. Everybody else has built in that hollow.
And just stayed where they were moved to
and just bought
things up to date and just stayed there.
In other words, my grandpa owned that whole hollow at one time. And he had about 8 kids all together, and he gave each one of the 8 kids a piece of land. And their daughters and sons built right there on that land, and now the granddaughters and grandsons are building on that land. So the all of them is just one big clan, for sure. That's a mountain clan right there.
But it is, the view up here is just beautiful.
Barbara, another little story. See this mountain here where the pines are? Now, all those pines are is new growth. 40 years ago, you could stand down in Waynesboro, down here, with a camera, and take a picture of that mountain right there, the whole mountain there. And it was in, now this was not just in here, it was on up on top yonder too. See the pasture field on top? But the whole mountain was in the picture of a cat. The pasture field looked like a cat from Waynesboro. And they let it grow up. But now, if you get an old newspaper from Waynesboro, they have like, they run it in the paper every now and then. But you look from Waynesboro up there, and you'll see a picture of a calf.
And that was sort of the shape of the tree the trees had taken?
The pasture field was in the shape of a calf.
Oh, the pasture field itself.
Right.
Oh,
they
I
had,
see.
They had, it had the tail, the legs, the head, and the eyes and everything. That hasn't been 30 years ago, you could see that. You could see the cat 30 years ago. But now, Waynesboro, East Virginia, right now, has copies of that. And of course, some older people in my little postcards with that cat. But now, that is why that is called Calf Mountain. That is Calf Mountain right there. And that's what that road builder is named by, Calf Mountain Road. And that used to be a picture of a calf above when you looked at the pasture field.
Well, now, who put their stock on that on that pasture?
It was probably as many as probably 10 people that owned land on that mountain.
And they just ran the herds together?
No, it was fenced in.
Oh,
divided.
The
whole thing was fenced in, In other words, this used to be the Harper place here, and Fretwell owned that on the top of it. That's what's called Fretwell's top rib beyond it.
Where that little denuded place is?
Right. Mm-hmm. That was called Fretwell's top. And then, of course, this over here, Uncle Hughes used to own that part of this green.
Well, that was Lance's.
Right, But you see something there. And, but now, if you wanted to see a copy of that calf of Waynesboro, East Virginia, then you would have a copy of it down there for sure. Right? That's what you'd have to do. S, whatever the first name, Mac Craig. That's what it was.
We're here in this graveyard, and the date on this tombstone that we're talking about is
1838. And let me see, what does that say at the bottom?
79, no.
I mean, 79 is what it looks like, but this looks like a Y here?
Yes.
This looks like A, don't it?
Yes.
You know why? I don't know what that could be.
79, that's... Past each grandfather, his mother took care of about 1,000 head of sheep for a many people. And he had a gun that he called to the rest he'd used to shoot as many as 12 dogs in one night who were attacking the sheep.
Barber. Now this is where my grandpap lived and where he raised 10 kids in this little cabin right here. This cabin has been here as long as anybody around here can remember. And it used to be a kitchen built onto the back side of it that came down this way. And it used to be as big as the kitchen part of it was big as the cabin itself. Frank O'Neill put that roof up there here about 15, 18 years ago. Up until that time, it was wooden shingles on it. And those wooden shingles were split here on the mountain itself. Somebody took and split them themselves and put them on. And the logs there, they came right out of the mountain here real close by. And the chimney there, the rock of that chimney came right off the place right here. Those logs there are chestnut logs, Barbara. You won't find those logs around this area. That is Native American chestnut logs there. This used to be the root cellar here. It wasn't very much room under there, but it done the job. They stored the potatoes and apples and cabbage heads and stuff like that under there. And that mortar between those logs there looks like it was made out of clay from up this way too. A lot of windows in it, so you usually didn't find a log cabin with too many windows in it.
Oh,
yes, it had an attic in it. It's got an attic in it, and that's where all the kids slept, 10 of them up in the top of that log house there. It was 7 boys and 3 girls in the family, and all of them were born and raised right there in that cabin. I doubt that, seriously. In fact, I doubt that they even had glass windows in there, Barbara. They probably had just shutters that they opened up and closed. Steps that went up there. Don't you know this place was hard to heat? This place was hard to heat, I would imagine.
Now, where is the door you said to the kitchen area that was...
Now this was the kitchen out here.
Oh, in the front?
Right, in the front. Now, it wasn't loud. So, it was made out of boards that they cut out the sawmill. Boards just like this, Barbara. It was made out of boards and 2x4s.
And that's where he's patched that, you think?
That's what they...
You see, there are the logs.
Right, that's what they put on there to keep air from coming through the cracks of the logs. And see, the kitchen used to come out about this area here, Barbara. In other words, the kitchen was about as big as the whole cabin combined. And that's where they spent
most... The living quarters was the kitchen.
That was mostly the living quarters. They stayed in the kitchen, done everything in the kitchen.
Well, now, where was the chimney for the kitchen?
It was out here.
It's just gone.
It's long. Well, they more than likely used just a pipe, a stove pipe, to go out and up. Just a stove pipe, more than likely. That's why you've seen all the old houses back in those days.
Now, tell me about this wall over here. This is a square.
Okay. Now,
like
this used to be the old barn over here, and the logs are still there, you can see. And they used to have hog pens around here made of chestnut logs. And of course, and over the many years, people has come in here and got a lot of that stuff. But now this spring right here is where they got all the water. And of course, they used to have a watering trough right here that the horses and cows would drink out of. I don't believe it's here anymore. But that's the spring there. And look what kind of stream of water is coming out of there, would you please?
Bastine said his grandparents weren't actually forced to move, but they closed the road so that they had to move because they had no access to this cabin that has been left standing. Bastine said this is one of the cases that where the government is not supposed to landlock people, but they did in his grandfather's case because once they closed the road, his grandparents had no way to get out, so they had no choice but to move. Bastine's grandparents were literate. They read and wrote. But the boys did not learn to read and write. The girls did. So therefore, Bastine's father was not able to read and write. His father never in his lifetime learned to read and write.
And neither did any of the other boys.
And none of the other boys in the family did either. Bastine said he thought his grandfather's reasoning was that the boys' future was hard work, cutting logs, railroad ties, taking care of the livestock. And they didn't need an education to do that. They just learned to do that as they grew up. I personally thought that he would have taught the boys to learn to read and write because they maybe would leave this area, whereas the girls would probably stay here and marry right into the mountain people.
You definitely
just walk along and tell the story.
You definitely want this on tape. Now, if you don't believe it, of course I can. Well, 1 year from the grandpa wanted to butcher his hogs, you know, back in those days, they just let their hogs run free over the mountains, and they'd eat these American chestnuts. That was their main food at the time. Of course, they ate a lot of acorns and other stuff, too, but the chestnuts were their main food source. And when they got ready to butcher the hogs, they just went out on the mountain there and got them and drove them in and butchered them. Didn't have to feed them no corn or anything because their meat was real good by eating all that chestnut. And 1 year, Grandpa sent his boys out to find the hogs, and they couldn't find them. It had been a deep snow, about 2 feet of snow, and of course the drifts was 10, 15 feet deep in those hollers up there. And they looked for about 2 weeks for those hogs, and they finally found them, and the whole bunch of them had got up against this cliff and lay down, and the snow had drifted over top of them, and they had been laying there in the snow for several days there without coming out for water or anything. And they finally found the hogs in there, drove them in, and butchered them. And you would think that the hogs would be in bad shape, but those hogs was just perfect for butchering and hadn't lost any weight, hardly come out to anything. In other words, they just kind of went into hibernation there and didn't use any energy, so they didn't lose too much weight. And Dad said that was probably as good a meat as they ever had out of hogs on that mountain.
That's probably one of the last he said. But I sure don't want to lose out talking about the farm. But see, we went down and we hiked about 15 miles to where, to the side of the mountain where the cabin is still standing. I spent hiking on the mountain with Bastine Fisher. I certainly can go along with learning through using your senses and experience, because we sure did see some things and learned. I certainly did see some things and learn some things. A couple of things that weren't on his tape, he was talking about how as children, particularly mountain children, they had to entertain themselves, and one of the ways they did this was with rock fights. And I asked him if he seriously meant rocks, and he said yes, that you teamed up and you stood a certain distance from each other, and then you tried to hit each other with rocks. And a lot of times people, the boys got hurt. He said he remembered one time that just he and his brother were having a rock fight, just the two of them, and he ran out of rocks. And the first thing he saw when he realized he had no rocks was a piece of broken saw blade, which he picked up and threw at his brother. And it hit his brother in his brother's forehead and actually embedded in his brother's head. So after they took took the saw blade out, they used camphor gum mixed with a little whiskey to put on the cut, which immediately stopped the bleeding. They just put a bandage around it, and he was not seriously hurt. Another story he told me that didn't get on his tape when he was talking was about his uncle, who had decided at the when he was a child to baptize their rooster. Now this took place at the old cabin where we hiked this afternoon, at the watering trough, which has long since fallen apart and disappeared. The young boy caught the rooster and held him by his neck and proceeded to dip his head in the water. And as he did so, he was saying, "I baptize thee in the name of the Father." Then he dipped him again in the name of the Son. And then he pushed his head down a third time and just kept thinking and thinking and thinking and never could think of Holy Ghost. And by the time he let the poor rooster up out of the water, the rooster had drowned. Even though Fastine's family was not actually in the forced migration, he did know a lot of stories about it. And he felt like that it was not so negative a move, that the people who came down out of the hollows and who actually adjusted and to the resettlement communities, all the places wherever they went, gained more than they lost. And he also feels like that because of the development of the drive and the national forest, that the city folk, as he calls them, now have access to the natural beauty, which if there was no drive and it was all private land, they would not have that access. He was a delightful person to talk to, and I thoroughly enjoyed the afternoon. Comments about the graveyard that are not on his tape. The picture I took of the headstone that said McCraig, one of the pictures I tried to get showed a hole in the very center of that square tombstone. And Fastine said that that hole was there because when they put this tombstone in place, a 3-foot square piece of marble sat atop the larger piece that had the name on it, and it was held together by a long bolt. It wasn't actually screwed in, but the bolt went through both pieces of marble, and over the period of time since this graveyard was established, someone, a tourist or hiker or whoever, has took the top piece and, of course, didn't even attempt to try to take the bottom piece. The top piece was about a 3-foot square, and it weighed probably at least 100 pounds, so whoever took it had a nice haul out of that mountain. He said as far as he could remember from stories told and what he'd heard, there probably had been no burial in that little cemetery for at least 60 years or more. And most of the people in that cemetery were from Sugar Hollow, which is the area that Arnold Vyer was from. And the people's names were Woods or McCraig or McCauley or Wolf or Vyer. And the only two tombstones that had any writing on them at all were with the name McCraig. And on that other tape, we were trying to decipher the year that was on one of the tombstones that had McCraig, but we neither one of us came up with an accurate date for what the letters of the alphabet meant either. It's rather sad to see the little cemetery so in such a state of disrepair. It was fenced in. The government had done that to try to keep people from bothering it. But the place was overgrown with vines and broken limbs and, of course, leaves. And a good many of the tombstones were only just slabs of slate with nothing written on them. And I guess if you buried your loved one there, you just had to know whereabouts in the area the person had been laid to rest, or else you'd never find it again. There was one place where the ground had actually sunk in, and whoever had been buried there, the ground had just sunk in and it kind of left a hole. It was nothing to see, though, as far as any kind of remnants of a coffin or anything. That was beneath the dirt. But there were a number of just slate, oblong slate pieces stuck in the ground to mark where people had been buried. As I say, though, it was kind of sad to see it in such a state of disrepair. Bastien said, as far as he knew, none of the generations following those people had made any effort whatsoever to go up there and maintain the graveyard, and I'm sure the government would have let them do that if they had wanted to. But most of those people at Sugar Hollow, they had all been moved out and dispersed, so I guess second, third generation didn't even bother to try to come back or keep any record of who might have been buried there. As I say, the only name we saw was McCraig, and that didn't identify anything except McCraig. You didn't know man, woman, child, or anything else. Correction, there were three tombstones with McCraig on them, and one of those was the one of which I took a picture that was just propped against a tree. It was just, we know that there was not a grave there because of the size of the tree that was right beside it. Here are several more things that I need to add after I listen to Bastien's tape. One thing he commented about that he knew from just stories that were told, that in some of the cases where the government had come in and told the people they had to move, the people would move out temporarily, and then when the agents would come back around to check, they would have advance notice somehow and go and hide. And the agents would come, of course, and find empty dwellings and assume that the people who lived there had gone, and then as soon as the agents left, the people would come back. No doubt the federal government agents caught on to this after not too much time. Two stories that he told that were not on the tape, partly because we were just walking along and talking, had to do with when we were coming from the cabin that we visited where his paternal grandparents had lived. One was that his aunt and uncle had been out at the woodpile chopping wood for their mother, and his aunt put her bare foot up on the chopping block and dared her brother to chop her toes off, and her brother did just that. He cut off four of her toes. So, of course, Bastien's grandmother came out and she took the toes and used camphor, gum, and ashes, and she put that around where the toes had been severed and put the toes back in place and bandaged the little girl's foot. And Arnold says that one of those toes reattached itself because he had actually seen his aunt's foot and saw that she only had three missing toes. The other story he told while we were at the cabin, when we were standing there close to where the remnants of the barn were, he said his grandfather had, of course, horses, and that one winter when they'd had a really heavy snow and severely cold weather, one of the horses had gotten out, evidently unknown to anybody, and the snow crust was firm enough that the horse was able to walk on the top of the snow, and the horse proceeded to go up the edge of the mountain toward the top, and evidently lost its footing. Now, I don't remember what gender horse it was, lost its footing and started sliding down the side of the mountain, and evidently there were not as many trees as there were when we were there today. Anyhow, the horse, of course, could get no way to stop himself, so he just kept sliding faster and faster down and went right on off the edge of the mountain and fell to his death. And I dare say that they didn't have, in those days, a horse was very valuable, so that was a considerable loss. Just like when he was talking about his uncle baptizing the rooster, they might have had a whole lot of chickens, but they probably didn't have a lot of roosters, so that anything that they lost through some unfortunate occurrence such as that was a considerable loss. When these people all were living on a poverty level state of existence.